Hello and welcome to the Media Law Podcast Newscast. Colette, Tom and Paul here to take you through the latest media law headlines. We've got updates on the Dyson and Leveson stories, more Tory MPs in hot libel water and a libel action about Richard III. But I want to start with the new proposed definition of extremism, which has been raised by the incumbent government. The new proposed definition says that core behaviours could constitute extremism, including attempts to overturn, exploit or undermine the UK system of liberal democracy to confer advantages or disadvantages on specific groups, or threatening individual rights or enabling the spread of extremism. This is wider than the current definition that's in place, and I wanted to get your thoughts on whether you think that this is necessary and an appropriate extension of the current definition.
Necessary? No. Dangerous? Yes. We've seen in recent weeks and months the current government of the UK seeking to sow and exploit division whilst decrying divisiveness. And it's nothing less than a nationwide campaign of gaslighting, I'm afraid. But a key part of that is to label certain viewpoints as extremist, certain groups as extremist. And in particular, we've seen that label being used by members of the government and also Conservative backbenchers to describe the protests by supporters of the Palestinian cause and the people of Gaza against the military action that Israel is undertaking in Gaza at present. And we've seen in the news numerous Conservative Party members, MPs, and members of the government talking about the protest marches in terms such as calling them hate marches, describing them as anti-Semitic. We've seen newspaper headlines in very recent days suggesting that London has become a no-go area for Jews, which of course the use of no-go area is a classic, I'm afraid, in recent years, Islamophobic trope that has been brought out time and time again to describe inaccurately areas, particularly in London and in Birmingham. And so we have to see the redefinition of extremism and the broadening of that definition in the context of a government that is seeking to label a very particular set of views as extremist. The worry is that if this is adopted, not so much I think that people will be prosecuted for it, because it would take a while to get new offences onto the statute books and so forth, but that it would become far easier for both central and local government to quickly and quietly cut off access to funding, access to permissions to demonstrate in particular areas, for example, to groups that have on occasion undertaken activities that fall within the new definition, or that could be said arguably to fall within the new definition. So broad is that definition. And you have things in it such as ideologies that seek to undermine the UK's tradition of democracy, representative democracy, and to undermine British values. Well, it's perfectly plausible to suggest that there are people out there that think representative democracy is not necessarily the height of human association, and there might be other ways to do things. It doesn't necessarily render those people extremist in the ordinary sense of the word. as for undermining British values, that vague, that's just so vague. It couldn't possibly form the basis of any criminal prosecutions, one would hope. But it's ripe for exploitation by a decision maker, and when the decision maker is a member of the government, because they're making decisions on funding, for example, a minister of state would decide whether to allocate funding to do something to a particular group, then it becomes, as I say, very easy to decide, no, we're not going to that group, based on a very woolly definition of extremism. So I do think it's troubling, but I also think it's very short-sighted. Because this is a government that, according to every electoral opinion poll out there, is entering its last few months of power for the foreseeable future. And from what they've been saying, those on the right, particularly of the Conservative Party, about a potential incoming Labour government, you only have to listen to some of the more rabidly right-wing figures to hear suggestions that an incoming Labour government will destroy the United Kingdom, and so on and so forth. One has to wonder why an outgoing government would want to broaden definition of extremism when they expect not to be the ones enforcing that broad and vague definition within a few months. It would be quite straightforward to make the case that, for example, one of the classic British values is the rule of law, that the policy of sending asylum seekers who arrive in the United Kingdom by small boat to Rwanda without processing legitimate asylum claims under international law, breaching our international legal obligations, runs contrary to the rule of law, and thus anybody who has not only promoted that policy and attempted to implement it, but who has enabled it, and arguably anybody who pays a subscription to the Conservative Party and is a member, or even anyone who casts a vote for the Conservative Party, has enabled such a policy, they would be an extremist. Now, why would you, as an outgoing government, want to open yourself and your members up to something like that? It seems to me to be spectacularly short-sighted. If you are genuinely terrified that the incoming Labour government, assuming that's what happens, is going to be some bastion of hard-left quasi-communism, then putting something like this on the statute book seems to me to be the last thing you'd want to do. But maybe it's just a sign of how delusional some people in government have become.
Yeah, there's something deeply ironic about this Tory government saying that British values are under attack. I mean, the most troubling British value that has been threatened in this present parliament has been the irresponsible rhetoric by which parliamentarians have conducted themselves, not only within parliament but outside parliament as well. And the very idea that senior figures in the Conservative Party would think it appropriate or consistent with British values for them to appear on their own TV shows on GB News, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Lee Anderson, etc., and then interview each other, or worse, have Rishi Sunak address the nation by stepping in for Jacob Rees-Mogg. I mean, that has been one of the most manifest threats to British values in recent times, to turn GB News into a propaganda channel, and then to accuse the BBC of bias. I mean, the audacity is beyond me. But this is the same Lee Anderson, of course, that espoused the very strange conspiracy theory that Sadiq Khan is actually being controlled by Islamists, who are controlling London, was downright bizarre. And although the Conservative Party did remove the whip from him and have suspended him, presumably until such time as he had apologised, he has, of course, now jumped the ship, and as all the brats do, to join Reform UK. There is a man who clearly has designs on extremism, according to this new definition.
The next story that I want to discuss today is that the science minister, Michelle Donnellan, has apologised and paid damages in settlement of a libel claim brought by two academics she accused of sharing extremist views, and one of them even of supporting Hamas. In a letter to the UK Research and Innovation Society, Donnellan encouraged the dismissal of Professor Kate Sang and fellow academic Dr. Kamna Patel from an expert advisory group on equality, diversity and inclusion. The UKRI suspended both academics during an investigation into whether they had shared extremist content and expressed sympathy for Hamas. Donnellan alleged that a Guardian article headlined "Suella Braverman urges police to crack down on Hamas support in UK," which was retweeted by Sang with the comment "This is disturbing," constituted evidence of her extremist support. The UKRI's investigation found no evidence to support Donlan's comments or remove the academics from their positions. Donlan has not admitted liability as part of the payments, but her department has confirmed that the £15,000 damages award will be paid out of the public purse. So this obviously just goes to the very point you were just making about the use of extremism as a political word and political tool. Do we want to comment on this particular apology and also the fact that the damages is coming out of taxpayer funds?
Yes, we do. For two reasons. First of all, the parallels between this government's actions and 1930s fascism in Germany have been made previously by Gary Lineker, who was accused of exaggerating and abusing his position at the BBC in order to make those comparisons. And yet, what did we find in Nazi Germany? We found senior figures in the Nazi Party having academics removed from their post for saying things that the government didn't like, particularly criticisms of that government. They silenced the intellectuals. Here we have a government minister doing exactly that, or trying at the very least to do exactly that, silencing dissent by removing or seeking to remove those key figures, and then insulating herself from the financial consequences of defaming these two academics by drawing money from the public purse. Both of these actions are deplorable. It wasn't the state that defamed these individuals. It was her, Michelle Donnellan. Why should she be reimbursed by the state for these actions, which are straight out of a 1930s fascist playbook?
From my perspective, it is one of the most disturbing instances of libel in recent times. And it's very personally disturbing because I, like the two victims of this particular libel, I'm an academic, and sometimes I express views on things. If you've made it this far into the podcast, you've just heard Paul and I talk about a definition of extremism which we both find to be disturbing, in the words of one of the two academics who was attacked. What is there to stop a government minister saying exactly the same thing about Paul and I, that we are in some way extremist sympathisers because we find the proposed definition disturbing? Answer, apparently nothing. The laws of libel theoretically protect us, but actually the taxpayer, it seems, will insulate a minister of state from liability. Now, Paul asked a question. Well, he says quite clearly there, it wasn't the state who defamed these people. By using taxpayer money to indemnify the minister, that is precisely what the government is saying. They are saying that it is the job of a minister of state to go around libeling academics. That is the clear inference from this. And that is deeply disturbing. I'm glad that the leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, came out firmly against this, and to say that this was very wrong and it would not happen under a Labour government. And one hopes that he remembers having said that in a few months or years time, or whenever it is that we, looking at the opinion polls, expect him to take office. But it's very disturbing. And what's perhaps more disturbing even than that are the reports coming out that Michel Donnellan received government legal advice prior to making the statement. Now, we don't know what the content of that advice was, and we will probably never find out because they don't release these things. But the idea that the government is putting out there the message that this was this happened after receiving legal advice, the inference the government is wanting us to draw is that the legal advice authorized this. If that were true, then that would be, again, deeply disturbing. And if we have government ministers ignoring legal advice that advises them not to say something like this, and I would expect good, competent legal advice to be don't say something like this, if we've got ministers coming out and simply ignoring the legal advice and making defamatory statements anyway, A, that clearly indicates that they are not acting within the scope of their ministerial responsibility, and B, it shows, frankly, that the minister concern is out of control and acting contrary to British values, such as respect for one's fellow citizens. So we might even say that Michel Donnellan has exhibited behaviour that, under Michael Gove's new definition, might constitute extremist behaviour.
Well, ministers have been, not just ministers, MPs as well, have been actively seeking, I think, to undermine academic freedom, which again is a behaviour that is inconsistent with British values, which ought to value academic freedom highly. But they have consistently been trying to attack and undermine that value. Specifically, in the aftermath of Brexit, there was the MP who demanded to know what was being taught at Ramona universities. More recently, with the Universities Act, which now necessitates that universities have to tolerate certain speakers, otherwise it's a breach of those speakers' freedom of speech. That was a really ham-fisted explanation of the new law that's just been passed, but hopefully you get the point. Increasingly, though, MPs, and again it speaks to a lack of responsibility, taking responsibility. Increasingly, MPs, particularly in the Conservative Party, seem to be auditioning for the role of leader, future leader of this party, by trying to be as outrageous as they possibly can, or the most noticeable as they possibly can, perhaps because they think that demonstrating firmness, being strict, is somehow an attractive quality in the leader. So we have Kemi Badenoch, Suala Braverman, who still is lingering around in the background, coming out with these outlandish statements. Michel Donnellan can be added to that list. Penny Mordaunt, every opportunity she gets. But in the case of Michel Donnellan, if she's claiming that actually she should be indemnified by the state for her actions because she was acting on behalf of the state as if she were the state, then we the people perhaps should be asking to see the advice that she was given. After all, we paid for it, so why shouldn't we be able to see it, so that we might challenge whether it is appropriate for her to be paid back for this callous act?
I think one for further thing that we really should acknowledge here is that the two victims of Michel Donnellan's statement were not, in a couple of important characteristics, just like me and Paul, in that both were female and women of colour. Now, women are already underrepresented in professional academia. Women of colour are seriously underrepresented in professional academia. And for them to be subjected to this kind of attack, an absolutely unwarranted attack by a government minister, I think has to be acknowledged as even more outrageous than it would be to say something similar about a couple of white men who, in academia. Because at the end of the day, the sort of perspective that is brought to bear on intellectual matters by someone who looks like me or looks like Paul is in greater abundance available than the perspectives of women of colour. So from my perspective, it's even worse because of those particular characteristics of the victim here. And I would like to think that those characteristics didn't consciously play a role in Michelle Donnellan's decision to make the statement, but I find it difficult to believe that, given the circumstances, given what she said, and given the general contextual background of the sorts of groups of people that this government is focusing its fire on at the moment, which I addressed a little earlier.
Another example of universities getting hit by the Tory party recently is from the Tory peer Jacqueline Foster, who's also paid damages and apologised after wrongly accusing an Oxford University Challenge team member of anti-Semitism for choosing to wear an octopus on their headscarf as their own personal mascot. Foster tagged Rishi Sunak, the BBC and Oxford University in a post on X and called for the student to be expelled from Oxford University and arrested. The octopus is a long-standing trope of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, but the BBC has since said that the episode was filmed in March last year, before the conflict in Gaza began. The broadcaster also said that the entire team picked the octopus as it was one of their favourite animals. In her statement apologising to the student, Foster said that, and I quote, "She made a grave mistake in making those posts and should not have done so. I again deeply apologise to Miss Gorginia for these allegations and any distress caused to her. We've since reached an amicable resolution. I do hope this goes some way in mitigating what has been a most distressing time for her, and I have agreed to pay substantial damages and her costs." So another example here of again, the extremism being used and potentially jumping the gun when it suits a political point.
Yeah. Did you know that Jules Holland's annual New Year's Hootenanny is filmed several months before New Year's? When I found that out, I was very disappointed, but I was not surprised, because that's how television works. If it's not going out live, and let's face it, University Challenge, where the teams appear to be on top of each other but aren't, because it has been edited, does not go out live. I mean, the sheer lack of thought that went behind this accusation is staggering. This person is a member of parliament. It seems not to have realised that television isn't always live. The people on the television aren't in your living room in a little box either. I mean, it's just staggeringly daft. But again, you have a politician, a right-wing politician, attacking a woman of colour in a bid to label her an extremist. It is fortunate that we have the libel laws that we do currently have that have enabled the three victims that we've now talked about to obtain redress, public apologies, for the libelous allegations that they have suffered. This is a government that has tried and continues to try to delegitimize and water down our libel laws. right? If, for example, we had the government had brought in some of the recommendations being made to it and by it on SLAPs, strategic lawsuits against public participation, I wouldn't be at all surprised if politicians in this sort of situation defended the claim rather than settled it and argued it was a slap. Because I'm talking about anti-Semitism and extremism, and why shouldn't I be able to put possibly false ideas, but notions out there for the public to think about? Doesn't it harm public participation if I can't raise the possibility that a television program that was filmed 9 months ago might be making points pertinent to events going on today? What would be in place to stop that sort of argument being made? Answer, nothing to stop it being made. Hopefully there'd be a sensible judge who would see through it and not uphold the argument. But we have to see this again in context. It all goes to trying to clamp down on the freedoms of certain groups of people to say certain things that certain other groups of people in power do not want them to say. And that is having a disproportionate effect on people of colour, women, academics, and what we have to protect them are libel laws that are themselves coming under frequent attack.
There is a basic lack of decency, if not intelligence, amongst the political class presently. And I'm reminded, the more that we talk about these things, I'm reminded of a very famous exchange between Jonathan Miller and Enoch Powell that took place in 1971 on the Dick Cavett Show in America, in which Miller tried to explain to Powell in very intelligent terms, very eloquent terms, why the charisma of Enoch Powell's office meant that his language, the famous Rivers of Blood speech, why the language that he used was so important because of the charisma of the office itself. The MPs, when they speak in the Houses of Parliament, when they speak outside the Houses of Parliament, have this tremendous weight of responsibility that they so often lose sight of, it seems, in their desperation for a soundbite, in their desperation to say something and be noticed, even when they have good intentions, which I'm not convinced was the case here, but even when they have good intentions, they forget the importance of thinking before speaking. And here we have just one more example of an individual who, as Tom says, if they had thought about it, may well have tried to claim that this was in fact a slap, that they were being prevented from contributing to democratic discourse on an important topic.
The next libel claim that I want to discuss is the one being brought by former leader of the Labour Party and independent MP Jeremy Corbyn against Nigel Farage, over Farage's allegation that Corbyn subscribes to an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. Farage made the comments last week, that's the first week of March, on his GB News TV show, and then reiterated them on Twitter.
I said the Jewish community in North America had been massively successful in law, in business, and yes, they did campaign for what they wanted. They did it within the law. They did it quite successfully, but I was never a subscriber to the madcap conspiracy theory that the Jews run the world. But I tell you who was. Yes, Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader that you supported.
So, do we think Mr. Corbyn has a claim here?
Yes.
Yeah, here we have the archetypal villain in Nigel Farage, who normally is very calculated in the things that he says. He's still a despicable person, but he's normally more calculated. But here, I think he's really going to struggle to substantiate this claim. Clearly it's defamatory, so it's just a question of defences. God knows what defence he'll go for. Maybe he'll try and claim public interest and say that he's been denied his opportunity of public participation in coming out with this drivel.
Best he'll be able to say is that this was his expression of an opinion, on the basis that to label a person a racist or an anti-Semite is a value judgment, and the courts have held that such allegations are value judgments in the past, and thus are expressions of opinion. Paul is shaking his head at me on the webcam, but there are cases in which this has been held. Not necessarily consistently, but there are cases in which this has been held. I know, because I wrote an article about it the other year. He could make the argument and try to defend it under Sanction 3, honest opinion, but he'd still have to prove that there were true underlying facts that supported the opinion. And I think he will probably find that difficult. It's straightforwardly defamatory on its face. I wouldn't expect this to go to court. This will be settled, and I think Farage will probably still feel he's got more out of making the statement than he has to give up by way of settlement.
The final new libel claim that I want to mention today is, on a slightly lighter note, which is that the comedian Steve Coogan is being sued for libel by a former University of Leicester academic who claims he was made to look devious and weasel-like in a film about the discovery of Richard III's remains. The Lost King was produced by Coogan and is a film about the search for the Richard III remains under the Leicester Council car park in 2012. During a preliminary hearing at the High Court on the 7th of March, Richard Taylor alleged that his character was made to appear, and I quote, dismissive, patronising and misogynistic towards Philippa Langley, a historian who played a key role in the search. What do we think about the likelihood of success at this claim?
I think there's on the face of it, from what I've read in the various media reports of it, so again, a nice lot of caveats there, there seems to me to be a colourable claim, yes. I'm astonished that those producing the movie didn't change the name of the character. That's the obvious thing to do. Whether or not you as writer and producer and whatever believe that what you're saying is true about a person, the portrayal that you're planning to make is true, you don't open yourself up to the liability of it. You fictionalize the character, you put a little note at the beginning saying that this has been dramatized and events not necessarily reflective of things that actually happened, and the characters don't necessarily resemble real people. And then you can have a character who behaves poorly towards another character without the threat of being sued. I mean, it would still be possible to bring a claim in defamation in theory, even if your name had been changed, if you said that there were certain people who could identify who the character really was. But the number of people who'd be in a position to do that would be very small and probably wouldn't get you past the serious harm threshold anymore. So it's the kind of situation that's best left to law school hypotheticals pre-2013. But yeah, it looks to me like there's a claim here. I can't believe that. Well, I can believe because I see that it doesn't happen, but I find it astonishing that the name of the character wasn't changed for the film. I think they've laid themselves open to liability, and I wouldn't be surprised to see this settle pretty quickly. I do wonder, given the statements that I've seen published in the press, have been reported from Andrew Caldicott Casey, who's defending. I wouldn't expect Andrew Caldicott, of all people, to defend a case if he didn't think there was some way to do it, which makes me think maybe not everything relevant has been reported in the press. Or maybe there's going to be an attempt to make a stand on Section 1, a preliminary hearing, on Section 1 or on meaning. But assuming that doesn't get anywhere, I would expect a settlement here.
I think the meaning point
point. Well, I suppose the question of whether it's whether it can be defamatory. Would someone watching the film believe the film to be true? I mean, like you say, Tom, they've sort of made a rod for their own backs here because they've used real names and real people and everything else. But could an argument be made that a reasonable person wouldn't necessarily conclude that it... So it wasn't portrayed as a documentary as such. I mean, I haven't seen the film, so I am speaking possibly out of turn here, but I did see the trailer, and during the trailer, the lead actress did seem to spend a lot of time sitting on a bench talking to the actual Richard III as if he was really there, which is interesting whether that... I mean, that sort of portrayed her as slightly deranged. Would she be able to bring a claim based on that? But given that there was a sort of fantastical element to it, would the average watcher believe that the claim... would the average watcher believe that the claimant in their portrayal was entirely accurate, or would they believe that it had been fictionalized to the extent of a sort of underdog type story where you need a kind of villain to bounce off?
The final two updates I wanted to give listeners related to the Dyson judgment and also the Leveson ledgers, which you've spoken about already in previous newscasts this year. So starting with Dyson, on the 27th of February, judgment on meaning was handed down by His Honour Mr. Justice Lewis in the long-running litigation between Dyson Group Companies and the broadcasters Channel 4 and ITN. Mr. Justice Lewis held that the news item first broadcast on Channel 4 News on the 10th of February 2022 made defamatory allegations of fact and of opinion. The judge found that the broadcast bore the following defamatory meanings of the claimant companies. First, that there are reasonable grounds to suspect that the claimants were responsible for the abuse and exploitation of workers. The persecution of a whistleblower at ATA, one of their supplier companies located in Malaysia, and that they tried to cover up the allegations and shut down public criticism. The court found the broadcast conveys a statement of opinion, being that the claimants have not lived up to their advertised standards of ethics and corporate social responsibility. So the trial will continue, and of course we will continue to provide updates as and when they come. Second is that on the 1st of March 2024, Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport Lucy Fraser and the Secretary of State for the Home Department James Kirkby published their decision to vary a restriction order from the Leveson inquiry to allow the use of ledger cards for the purposes of the ongoing misuse of private information claim brought by seven claimants, including Prince Harry, against Associated Newspapers. So information from those ledgers about press conduct at the time of Leveson will now be allowed to be included as part of that ongoing MPI claim. Thank you very much, Tom and Paul, for your excellent insights, as always.
Thanks, Colin.
Thanks, Claire.
As ever, follow us on social media, and we will be back with more newscasts in the weeks to come. Thanks very much. Bye.
Bye-bye.